whose one and only duty was to name the storms, in a far-sighted move after men. The first name chosen was, naturally, Adam. The second, Benson, after then-Secretary of Agriculture Ezra Taft Benson. And folklorist J. Frank Dobie saw the sunny side of the issue. He told of a Texas Ranger who, in the aftermath of a sandstorm, spied a cowboy hat on the ground. Picking it up, the Ranger discovered a man's head underneath. Frantically, he dug out the buried cowpoke, who coughed, spat, and croaked out, "Get a shovel. There's a good horse under me." Thank you for joining us for Texas Monthly Archives, as volunteers and staff from the Recording Library of West Texas read. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Magazine, followed by Travelin' Texas at 4.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 87 and partly cloudy. Tonight, a few showers with a low in the low 70s. Then tomorrow, a few showers with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
If it's in Texas, it's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm KC Jobe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on site in the sound broadcasting, and our first article will be from our new May issue. It's one of our feature articles. It's by Joe Levin and Ivan Mizell. It's entitled, "The Eyes Have It." Last summer, a group of UT football players launched a viral campaign to reckon with the university's history of racism. Their controversial effort to replace the school's alma mater, the Eyes of Texas, incited the ire of many alumni and wealthy boosters. This is the behind-the-scenes story of the unprecedented season that followed. When you go back and look at it, really look at it, it's not even a good image. It was shot on a phone, strangely cropped, blurry, but it sure captured a moment. The photo, taken of University of Texas quarterback Sam Ellinger at around 4 p.m. at the Cotton Bowl Stadium in Dallas on the second Saturday of last October, carved its own path, the way that viral media posts and the most destructive tornadoes do. When you heard it, cost a coach his job. Maybe you saw it and felt outrage at the supposed lack of respect it depicted. Maybe you cheered the young athletes who protested a song with racist origins. But the story the photo tells isn't exactly what happened. Several minutes had elapsed since Oklahoma had beaten Texas 53-45 in a four-overtime thriller that ended when Ellinger threw an interception in the end zone. Ellinger's helmet now hung from his left hand while he held his right hand up in the hook 'em horns sign. He stood at attention during the playing of the Eyes of Texas, university alma mater. It's odd that the photo has often been described as showing Ellinger alone. There are about a dozen others, mostly coaches and trainers in the frame, all facing away from the camera. But the reason this photo rekindled the brush fire that had consumed much of the Texas football program in 2020 is that not a single one of those others is a Longhorn football player. Zoom out a little, and you'll see a different narrative. Defensive tackle Taquan Graham also stayed out there for the song, standing about 5 yards out of frame. Other Longhorns remained on the field as well. If you could add sound to the image, you'd understand that the Cotton Bowl's tinny PA system made it hard to hear the Eyes of Texas, and many didn't even know that it had started to play. If you're able to rewind a few weeks, you'd see that much of the scene captured after the Oklahoma game mirrored the aftermath of the three previous contests. By then, nearly every UT player had made a habit of leaving the field after the final whistle, protesting the Eyes of Texas because of its roots in minstrelsy. But the photo didn't say all that. For four seasons, the TV networks had made an almost weekly refrain of how Ellinger, a preseason candidate for the Heisman Trophy and a star of the college football hype machine, played to honor his late father, a Texas grad who took Sam to games as a child. The news stations had gotten a lot of mileage out of an Ellinger family photo of Sam as a young kid in overalls, putting his horns up. So for many Longhorn fans who saw the photo, it said, here's the only player who loves his school. Here's a player who's done everything he could to help his team defeat its rivals. Where are his teammates? The photo said they didn't care about the University of Texas. The photo was wrong. It's wrong about that, and it's wrong that it cost the coach his job. But that should come as no surprise. If you had to pick a theme for the last 12 months of Longhorn football, it just might be miscommunication. After the photo went viral, alumni and students flooded the inboxes of university officials with impassioned emails, some of which were published by the Texas Tribune. The spectrum of reactions ranged from a donor who suggested that the university encourage black students to select an alternate school now, to a UT freshman who said, if something offends a certain demographic of people and they've been outspoken about it and they have every right to be offended by it, I think we should be listening to them. One donor wrote about the protest, my wife and I have given an endowment in excess of $1 million to athletics. This could very easily be rescinded if things don't drastically change around here. Cain and Abel's and Austin Barr printed shirts that said, Stand with Sam. Someone hired a plane to tow a sign with the same message during the next game. Most of the players, meanwhile, only wanted an honest reckoning with the song's history. It's not that the athletes would be winning by getting the song removed and boosters would be losing, said Joseph Osai, the team captain and star outside linebacker. It's about saying, is this morally right? The tension had simmered since June, when in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, a multiracial group of Longhorn athletes published a letter on social media requesting a series of changes to make UT more equitable and inclusive. Final request urged the school to get rid of the alma mater. The resulting dispute, initially about a song, quickly transformed into a discussion about belonging and control, and really about the soul of the university. Who is welcome at UT? Who gets to decide what it represents? The 2020 Texas Longhorns will be remembered much longer than most 7-3 teams. This controversy will be their legacy. In interviews with dozens of coaches, athletic department officials, university administrators, and current and former Longhorn players, Texas Monthly found that the players were largely left to navigate the turmoil by themselves. Said one source inside the athletic department, some people used these players and others just sat on the sidelines and didn't give them any help when they needed it. On June 1st, 7 days after the killing of Floyd, who died in Minneapolis but grew up in Houston, the Longhorn football team logged on for a 3-hour Zoom call while protests erupted across the country. College football team meetings in the early summer of 2020 looked much like every other pandemic-era gathering. Players' faces crowded the screen. They had to mute and unmute themselves. It was not the best forum for depth and nuance, but the Longhorns felt they needed a talk. Players voiced frustrations, asked questions, and discussed ways they could get involved. At some point, athletic director Chris Del Conte expressed his support for the players. Over 15 years as an athletic director at Rice, TCU, and since 2017, Del Conte had established himself as a fundraiser nonpareil, a tireless salesman. Del Conte knows how to make a pitch. He reminded the Longhorns that, as the public face of the university, they had a unique platform to inspire change. Use your voice. Be united and speak out, he told them. The players came away with an implicit message from Del Conte. If they took action, they would have the athletic department's full support. The conversation expanded from there. What exactly could the Longhorns do to take advantage of the moment? On a Zoom call, one team leader brought up the Eyes of Texas. The alma mater had been an integral part of the lives of UT alumni for generations. It is sung at weddings, funerals, and birthday parties, and of course by 100,000 fans at Longhorn football games. The Eyes was even sung in the movie Giant, and, anachronistically, in the John Wayne film The Alamo. The battle was fought 67 years before the song was written. Elvis sang it in Viva Las Vegas, marching around a dance floor, beating a bass drum. Astronaut UT alum Alan Bean famously had the lyrics printed on a piece of silk so he could take them on his 1969 trip to the moon. Del Conte had first experienced the hold that the alma mater has over his constituency in March 2019 when he attended the funeral of Johnny Lamb Jones, a standout Longhorn wide receiver and 1976 Olympic gold medal sprinter, at Ebenezer Third Baptist Church in Austin. They sang the whole song as his casket was being laid to rest, Del Conte said recently. It didn't occur to him that it might be odd that this took place at the funeral of a black man. My point of view was, people sang the song with great pride, he said. That would change. I need to educate myself too, Del Conte said. In truth, the song's problematic history had been an open secret for years. Just 2 years before the football team's Zoom meeting, UT student government had debated the merits of the Eyes. About a decade ago, a group of Longhorn basketball players refused to sing it after learning its history. Neither movement caused a stir, But now that monuments to the United States racist history were toppling around the country, the song's provenance got renewed attention. The Eyes of Texas was completed in 1903. Lewis Johnson, a law student, attended Austin for the express purpose of writing a school song. He recruited John Lang Sinclair, an undergrad known as the campus poet, to help him compose the lyrics. They lived in Brackenridge Hall, the campus residence for poor students at the time. Sinclair wrote one tune, Jolly Students of Varsity, that they quickly consigned to oblivion. For we are jolly students of the varsity, we are a merry, merry crew. Johnson asked Sinclair to try again, and when he came down with a case of writer's block, a few members of the Glee Club locked him in his dorm room. According to some accounts, they actually forced him into his closet with some cigarettes. They told him he couldn't come out until he had a song. A few hours later, Sinclair handed over a piece of brown paper, a wrapper torn from a laundry bundle. It contained the first draft of a poem written in pencil with words scratched out and revised. Lines 5 and 6 read, "The eyes of Texas are upon you all the livelong day." The title echoed the favored refrain of University President William Prather, who ended nearly every speech with the saying, hoping to encourage students to work hard and act with integrity. In a 1900 address, Prather explained to students that his saying was inspired by a Confederate brigadier general who once told his troops, "The eyes of General Lee are upon you." Prather used the phrase so much that students started to make fun of him. At one event, one student leaned over to another and said, "Bet you a quarter, he says, eyes of Texas." He won the quarter. Sinclair seemed to want to spoof the president, and he set the poem to the tune of "I've Been Working on the Railroad," which was itself based on the Levy song, whose lyrics referenced the use of black labor to build infrastructure across the South. Sinclair wanted the music to be familiar, so those hearing it would pick it up quickly. The song debuted at a May 1903 minstrel show, the proceeds of which went to UT track team. Prather was in the large crowd. The evening included skits, dances, and songs, many performed in blackface and featured other grotesque stereotypes. A vocal quartet kicked in with the first public performance of The Eyes of Texas. It's almost certain that the singers remained in blackface. The audience so loved the song that it demanded an encore. The quartet performed the song at least four times that night. Soon after, the marching band learned it and paraded through campus as students sang the words. When Prather, who took the song in good humor, died 2 years later, it was performed at his funeral, and Johnson later wrote that the song then became something closer to a reverential hymn. That journey from parody to hymn happened quickly. Soon after the minstrel show, The Eyes became an even more popular fixture at UT banquets, graduations, and football games. A group of women sang it during a Longhorn football game in 1916, breaking their customary silence in the stands for the first time. Students sang it at the Capitol in 1944 after the UT Regents fired the university president for his role in trying to expand opportunities for black students as a member of the Biracial Conference on Negro Education in Texas. Soldiers sang it before storming the beaches of Normandy. During a Zoom meeting with players, head coach Tom Herman weighed in. Like Del Conte, Herman said this was the first he'd heard of issues with the song. "If you want to take that on," he told the team, "you better be unified and get your facts right." But he didn't tell them not to do it. The message the team took away again appeared clear. Take on the eyes, and the coach would support his players. Later that day, Herman discussed the meeting on The Herd with Colin Cowherd, a national sports talk radio show. "When you love somebody the way that we love our players, and you see them hurt, and you see them angry, and you see them frustrated," Herman said, "much like a parent, you want to take all of that off their heart, and you want to put it all on yourself and be there for them and provide some guidance for them." You couldn't script a better message for the head coach to deliver. "Coaches raised me," Herman said on The Herd. "The reason I got into this job was to have an impact on young men's lives the way that coaches had on mine." Some UT players believe that Herman was genuinely trying to make that sort of connection with them, but many others did not. Herman was entering his fourth season in Austin. He'd arrived from the University of Houston, whose middling football program he'd quickly turned into an unlikely powerhouse. Known as a tactical football prodigy, he'd come to Texas billed as a savior for a proud program that had slipped into mediocrity. But thus far, his record of 25-15, while miles ahead of the numbers posted by his predecessor, Charlie Strong, didn't match the high expectations of his fan base. Before the season even began, Herman sat on the proverbial hot seat. Herman had made a bootstrap climb to the top. His father struggled with alcoholism and homelessness. Herman had to ask his high school coach to teach him how to tie a tie. He played wide receiver at Division III California Lutheran University, where he demonstrated such impressive football acumen that upon graduation, his head coach brought him on staff. and off Herman went. Power 5 coordinator at 33, national championship ring under Urban Meyer at Ohio State at 39. At Houston, Herman drew national attention for kissing his players on the cheek before each game. "How do you motivate a human being to do things against his own nature?" Herman said to the New York Times. "There's two things, love and fear, and to me, love wins every time." But that's not the Herman described by his players in Austin. "He had," one former UT wide receiver said, "a very arrogant attitude and came across as unapproachable. Once Herman used the word diminutive in a team meeting, then turned to a player and asked, 'Do you even know what that means?'" According to sources at every level of the program, Herman either had trouble connecting or failed to make it a priority. "One day he may know your name, one day he doesn't address you," an athletic administrator said. "He's an absolute genius when it comes to, you know, statistics, knowledge, all that stuff," one player said. "What's lacking is the emotional intellect." Herman also kept the Texas alumni at arm's length, and he rarely allowed former Longhorn players access to his team. He had not developed any key alliances at a place where it's really important to have key alliances, a good friend of Herman's said. "Some people aren't wired that way. Tom thinks my work product is my work product, and it speaks for itself." Some coaches have found success this way. Alabama's Nick Saban turned brusqueness into an art form. Urban Meyer, Herman's former boss at Ohio State, is an unapologetic autocrat. But at Texas, the only two coaches since World War II to win national championships have been Darryl Royal and Mack Brown. They liked pleasing people, and they moved naturally among the wealthy, powerful alumni and donors who, more than anything, wanted to flaunt their influence and access. Royal and Brown made those exes, as Texas alumni call themselves, feel as if the head coach cared about their football opinions. The two men also endeared themselves to maintenance workers and others around the 40 acres. An old hand on campus who worked with them both said they operated under the same mantra: "You can judge a man by how he treats someone who can't do a thing for him." Herman, who declined through his agent to be interviewed, seemed to have put himself on an island. According to one of the six assistants Herman hired when he overhauled his staff after going 8-5 in 2019, the pitched battle over the eyes of Texas would become a tipping point. The assistant added, "There was a lack of trust from the moment I got there." A couple days after the June 1st meeting, several players started a group chat for those who wanted to move forward with enacting change, according to the team captain Osai. They discussed sitting out the entire season, but ultimately decided a boycott would be counterproductive. They could make a larger impact if they utilized the spotlight they attracted on Saturdays in the fall. Six of the players gathered the group's sentiments and met with a Dallas-based attorney, Abel Mulligetta, to draft a letter of request to the university. They then sent it to captains of other Longhorn teams and coordinated a time to release it on social media at midday on June 12th. The student athletes' requests included renaming four campus buildings bearing the names of avowed racists and removing a statue of James Hogg, a Texas governor during the Jim Crow era. They asked that statues of a diversity of alumni be erected, that incoming freshmen be given the opportunity to learn about the history of racism on the campus, and that the university create an outreach program in the state's inner cities. At the end of the letter came a request that "The Eyes of Texas" be replaced by a song without racist undertones. The letter went viral. Brennan Eagles, a junior wide receiver, received more than 5,200 likes and more than 1,500 retweets. The players had also expected pushback, but the level of vitriol that was unleashed came as a shock, especially when it pertained to the Eyes. 5 days after the release of the letter, Del Conte, Herman, and interim university president Jay Hartzell addressed the growing controversy with the team. Hartzell, the former dean of the McComb School of Business at UT, had been on the job for a little more than 2 weeks. His position became official in September, but at the time, how he reacted to the strife would play a role in determining whether he got the job. He had never spoken to the football team. He told the players they were bringing change to the university. "I'm proud of you," Hartzell said. But the message from Del Conte and Herman lacked the clear support the players thought they had received a few days earlier. "You don't have to sing The Eyes of Texas right now, but guess what," Del Conte said. "There are a lot of guys on the other side of this song that don't understand why you're thinking the way you're thinking." One player recalls that he felt Del Conte was trying to play devil's advocate and be on our side while also being on the donor's side. "Just shoot it straight, man." Herman told the players he was hurt because they hadn't consulted him before releasing the letter. "I definitely want to help," he said in the meeting, "but don't go behind my back." In the locker room, the meeting didn't sit right. Many thought Del Conte, Hartzell, and Herman had been dismissive. Juwan Mitchell, a junior linebacker, wrote on Twitter, "For once, we decide to voice our opinion about things that can help better the community. It seems they only got our front, but not our backs. With that being said, I do not feel comfortable representing the University of Texas." The meeting didn't sit right with certain alumni either. Throughout that month, according to a reporting from the Texas Tribune, a group of boosters and big-name alumni pressed university leaders to keep the song. They included many graduates of the McCombs School of Business, where Hartzell had served as dean, Colt McCoy, former Longhorns quarterback who is now with the Arizona Cardinals, and rich oil men like Bud Brigham. Bill Stanley, a wealthy chemical engineer whose donations to the school have exceeded $2 million, circulated a letter questioning Hartzell's leadership specifically for a meeting with the players. "This current, highly emotionalized and factually inaccurate movement is counterproductive, will generate more divisiveness, and also destroy the progress made in integration up to now," wrote Stanley. "It is being fomented by socialistic groups that are using the blacks as pawns. It is regrettable that the university has accepted this movement." In July, the team again gathered to speak with Del Conte, Hartzell, and Herman. The officials announced that the university had agreed to many of the requests in the letter. Among other initiatives, the university would rename buildings, redistribute some athletic department revenue to recruit, attract, retain, and support black students, and erect a statue of Julius Whittier, Longhorns' first black letterman, outside the stadium. Then talk turned to the eyes. Del Conte announced that the song would remain. It would still be played after every game, he said, but anyone who felt uncomfortable wouldn't have to participate. Del Conte says now that he never told players they had to stay on the field because it never crossed his mind that they wouldn't. To many players, though, it sounded as if Del Conte had given them permission to, as Osai said, treat the song like elevator music. But even as players accepted the agreement, some felt spurned by what they viewed as a lack of support from their coach. "Come on, man," one player said. "Don't start backtracking your word. You encouraged us to do this. Shit just hit the fan ever since." For years, the Eyes of Texas had been elevator music. In the football building, the elevator played the Texas fight going one way and the Eyes of Texas going the other. But in 2020, the elevator went on hiatus. It sat smack in the middle of an ongoing $175 million renovation of the south end zone at Darrell K. Royal, Texas Memorial Stadium. When the project is finished this fall, the stadium will feature new luxury suites. Just south of the football stadium, construction is underway for the Moody Center, University's new basketball arena. UT is responsible for a portion of its $338 million price tag. As athletic director, Del Conte is essentially the CEO of a corporation that generated $200.8 million in revenue in the 2019-2020 fiscal year. When the players released their letter, Del Conte was juggling several knives at once. Pandemic, civil unrest, and the financial chaos caused by not selling football tickets. Chaos that included laying off some 35 staffers and furloughing others. Del Conte said the deficit created by limited ticket sales could have risen as high as $50 million, but ultimately settled at $19 million. Del Conte said that no donors pulled pledges because of the eyes, but the perception became that players and students represented one side of the debate and wealthy donors represented the other. "The big money loves the song," said one former Longhorn football staffer, "and now it's gotten so polarized, it's gotten like the national anthem to some people." Jay Boulware, the Longhorns' associate head coach last season, who played for Texas in the 90s, said, "I'm a black alum, my wife is a black alum, and we both love the school's song. It didn't change because somebody sang it in blackface. This song, to a lot of people, has nothing to do with race. It has to do with school pride." But when the coaches discussed the issue in a staff meeting, Boulware gave a frank assessment. "This crap," he said, "is going to get us fired." At practice before the September 12 opener against UT El Paso, a player asked Herman what would happen after the game. Herman replied that the song would be played and said that nobody had to stay on the field if they didn't want to. He asked him, however, not to kneel. "But what will you do?" a player asked. "I'm going to stay out there and thumb my horns up," Herman said. He explained that the university was his employer and someone had asked him to remain on the field. "Who?" responded one player. Herman answered by saying only, "The administration." When the Longhorn Band plays The Eyes of Texas, the arrangement begins with a 10-second prelude, a long build-up for a piece that the band concludes in 50 seconds. That says something about showmanship, yes, but it also dramatizes the emotions that the song brings to the surface. Many of UT's most beloved traditions have shallow roots. The school didn't officially adopt burnt orange until the mid-60s, when Coach Royal grew tired of the brighter orange uniforms fading to yellow. The Hookem hand sign dates only to 1955. UT Tower, the university's signature building, was finished in 1937. The Eyes of Texas, on the other hand, is about as old as the university itself. Nearly everything that's ever occurred at the University of Texas has been accompanied by the song, for better or worse. But because of COVID-19 protocols last season, even some of the most hallowed football traditions were put on hold. No one could guarantee that any one game would take place at all. Texas never did play Kansas last season. Game days took on an alien feel. University banned tailgating. The total attendance for the Longhorns' 5 home games, 85,690, fell well short of current stadium capacity of 100,119, and the Longhorn band didn't perform at any games. Almost immediately after the final whistle of UT's season-opening 59-3 rout of UTEP, University of Texas at El Paso, a pre-recorded version of the Eyes of Texas began emanating from the stadium sound system. Players and coaches, still shaking hands with the miners, appeared confused at the song as the song began playing so quickly. The team usually gathered to sing it together. Now they had to decide what to do on their own. For the majority, it was an easy call. If the song made their teammates uncomfortable, they wouldn't sing it. "I love my teammates more than I love the song," said linebacker Court Jacques. As the song continued, Herman hugged a UTEP assistant coach. He didn't put his horns up, nor did he sing. No one seemed to pay any mind. The Longhorns followed the UT El Paso win with a 63-56 overtime victory at Texas Tech, their defensive shortcomings casting a pall over any excitement that resulted from moving up to number 8 in the Associated Press ranking. Following week, TCU did what it has done so often in 20 seasons under head coach Gary Patterson. The Horned Frogs stole a 33-31 victory against a more talented UT team. Then came Oklahoma. The Sooners arrived at the storied Red River Showdown with a losing record, 1-2, for the first time since 1997. Herman's Texas teams had lost 3 of 4 to their rival, but this year, Oklahoma had an inconsistent young quarterback, and Texas had Ellinger, a 4-year starter. Just as he had against Texas Tech, Ellinger led a dramatic fourth-quarter comeback, scoring 2 late touchdowns to force overtime. Texas, though, didn't capitalize on multiple chances to win, and the Ellinger interception in the fourth overtime ended the game. Most of the players quickly headed to the locker room, as they had after every game, but this time someone happened to snap the photo of Ellinger singing the alma mater without his teammates. Austin TV station KXAN tweeted that photo, and suddenly the team was making national headlines once again for non-football reasons. The wisdom of football's internal clock dictates that whatever emotion is stirred by a game on Saturday is behind on Sunday. Win or lose, no matter. A new opponent is on the horizon. But that week, the Texas Longhorns didn't have a new game to look forward to. Any football veteran can tell you that an off week after a loss can feel longer than Anna Karenina. The players had no imminent challenge to focus on. Instead, they had to return to what by now felt like a very old challenge. The photo of Ellinger and the reaction to it had refreshed the battle over the Eyes of Texas. Take a little break here. It's a natural spot here. Remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight into Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Broadcasting since 1967, and now back to our text. In the locker room, the prevailing sentiment was confusion. Why now? One player remembered thinking. Why is this a thing now? All season long, the team had left the field before the Eyes played. They felt frustrated and confounded as to what had changed. More than anything, they cratered emotionally over the loss to Oklahoma. If we had won most of these games, a wide receiver said, no one would have cared. But because we were losing, fans want to blame something else. On Monday, Herman began his weekly press conference by reading a 2-minute statement in which he tried to straddle the university's decision to keep the song and the sentiments of his players who'd shunned it. "We will continue to encourage participation for all of those that are comfortable doing so," Herman said. "That said, some members of our program have concerns and aren't comfortable participating at this time, and I respect that as well." Outrage among alumni reached a fever pitch. President Hartzell said that threats made via email didn't influence any of the university's decision-making. which would make UT the rare university impervious to donor pressures, and he denounced the openly racist messages, of which he said there were a few. But some emails suggested that anger from donors was, in some quarters at least, a very real concern. Alumni are pulling planned gifts, canceling donations, walking away from causes and programs that have been their passion for years, even decades, and turning away in disgust. Last night, one texted me at 1 o'clock in the morning, trying to find a way to revoke a seven-figure donation. Kent Kostka, the president of the Longhorn Alumni Band Charitable Fund Board of Trustees, wrote to Hartzell and other administrators. This is not hyperbole or exaggeration. Real damage is being done every day by the ongoing silence. On Wednesday, Longhorn football players filed into a meeting room on the 8th floor of the North End Zone. Del Conte framed the Eyes of Texas issue as a matter of unity and tradition. At one point, he said simply, "I need your help." He wasn't going to make anybody sing, but he asked the team to remain on the field while it played. One official at the meeting expressed his concern that the 2020 Longhorns might have trouble getting jobs in the state after graduation. "I felt pretty threatened by that," said a receiver. "I mean, getting a job after football is really important to me." Others interpreted the message differently. "Some people took this as him threatening us and told us we weren't going to get a job," one linebacker said. "I interpreted it as him being concerned." When Herman spoke, he reinforced Del Conte's perspective, but players hardly recognized their normally cocksure coach. "He looked like he was ready to cry," one player said. The next day, the team's leadership council, a collection of players from each position group, met to discuss the Eyes. Many vented about the way the media had portrayed the protests, about losing, about Herman, Del Conte, and everyone else in charge. Mostly, they vented that the issue remained unsettled. Team captain Osai stood up. "Let's change this," Osai said. "What could we do?" Some said that they weren't going to budge on their opposition to the song. Things got heated. Then Ellinger spoke. "We're here to effect positive change," he said. "We've done that. We will do that. But we've got to get better," he said, referring now to the team's performance on the field. "We can't be 2-2. He clarified what the song meant to him. Every time he sang, he thought of his late dad. It reminded him of going to games with him. It brought back happy memories. He talked about how he had supported his teammates when they released the letter, not because he necessarily agreed or understood, but because they were his teammates. He looked around the room and focused on Caden Stearns, who'd been the most vocal leader in protesting the song. "Caden, will you stand with me?" "Yes," Stearns said. Ellinger asked other teammates one by one. The entire leadership council agreed. Now they had to get the rest of the team on board. At a players-only meeting, Ellinger delivered a similar speech to the entire team. When Ellinger finished, Stearns told his teammates that he still wouldn't sing the song, but he would stay on the field and stand with his quarterback. The team rallied around him. After the following game, a 27-16 victory at home against Baylor, every player remained on the field. Few sang, some talked with each other while a song played, some talked with the cheerleaders, a few knelt. From that point on, the Longhorns won 5 of their final 6 games, but it wasn't enough to save Herman's job. A few days after Texas beat Colorado in the Alamo Bowl, Texas announced as its new head coach Steve Sarkisian, defensive coordinator for Alabama, and one of the most sought-after coaching prospects in the country. That Texas won the sweepstakes for Sarkisian spoke to the enduring power of the Longhorn brand and the wealth of its alumni donors. Herman and staff are owed a $24 million buyout. But if UT had any hopes that a new coach would help turn the page on the Eyes of Texas controversy, that optimism was quickly dispelled. During Sarkisian's introductory press conference, when asked about the alma mater, he said, "I know this much. The Eyes of Texas is our school song. We're going to sing that song. We're going to sing that proudly. That's our song, and we're fired up to sing it." His comments would make headlines everywhere, from the Washington Post to USA Today. A few players were watching the press conference together, sharing a meal. "Ah, shit," one of them said. "Here we go again." On a foggy Tuesday morning in March, every Longhorn student-athlete had an early wake-up call. They'd been summoned to the Frank Irwin Center, the basketball arena on the edge of campus, at 8 a.m. to hear the results of a much-anticipated report on the Eyes of Texas that Hartzell had commissioned months earlier. He'd tasked a 24-person committee that included current students, historians, alumni, faculty, and current and former athletes with examining the history of the Eyes. Hartzell addressed the athletes and emphasized his pride in what they had started the previous summer to make the campus more inclusive and welcoming to black students. Then he turned it over to the head of the committee, Richard Reddick, the Associate Dean for Equity, Community Engagement, and Outreach in the UT College of Education. He and others unveiled the major findings of the roughly 50-page report, It confirmed that the song had been first performed at a minstrel show. That the Eyes of Texas was most probably debuted in blackface is a painful reality of the song's origin. We are uncomfortable with this aspect of its history. We believe it is important to fully acknowledge and learn from the university's past. The report ultimately concluded that the lyrics had no racist intent. Though the song debuted at a minstrel show, the commission said they found no evidence that it was written specifically for minstrelsy. More likely, they said, the song's creators wanted only to premiere their work at a well-attended event. The report further contended that the lyricist, Sinclair, did not write in dialect, a common form of stereotyping in that area. It also dispelled the widely held belief that the phrase, "the eyes of Texas," was inspired by a favorite saying of a Confederate General, Robert E. Lee, though it did confirm connections to a different Confederate officer, Brigadier General John Gregg of Texas. Back to the backlash to the report came quickly, with some vehemently disputing its conclusions. Alberto A. Martinez, a UT history professor, published his own report on the song, including evidence that it was specifically written for the 1903 minstrel show. He cited a 1926 Dallas Morning News article written by Prather's daughter, Mary Lou Prather Darden, describing exactly that. At a March 29 press conference at the Capitol, Martinez, along with a group of students, legislators, and Texas NAACP President Gary Bledsoe, argued that the university contradicts itself when it says that a song that originated in a minstrel show had no racist intent. "We ought to make it clear," said Bledsoe, "that the report issued by the 24-member committee should not be used to sanitize or justify a song that debuted in minstrel shows with lyrics that were embraced because of lore that connected them to Confederate General Robert E. Lee." In a university-wide email, Hartzell wrote of wanting to make UT a pioneer of a new model for hard conversations. He suggested that the Eyes of Texas report is the first step in that process. "It seems strange for an institution of higher education that does research and teaches to not do research and then teach," Hartzell said later. "How can this issue that's so difficult about race in our society not be one where we do the research and we teach?" Hartzell also reaffirmed that, contrary to earlier suggestions by Del Conte and Sarkisian, players won't be required to stay on the field for the Eyes of Texas. When the 2021 season begins on September 4, a home game against the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, Ellinger will have graduated, and promises by other players to stand for the alma mater presumably will have expired. Much attention will be paid to who remains when and if the Longhorn Band strikes up the song. Texas is not the first school to have trouble coming to terms with racial symbols. Ole Miss banned the Confederate flag from its football games in 1997. It took 19 more years for the university to also ban the playing of Dixie. Many Ole Miss alums were persuaded the song needed to go only after evidence was presented that it was harming recruiting for the football team. According to the sports website The Athletic, Texas's commitment to its alma mater is already being used by other colleges as a tool to dissuade top high school players from signing on as Longhorns, though there's no evidence that it's working. Texas has lined up yet another strong recruiting class. Throughout the day that the university's report on the Eyes was released, the Longhorn teams met for further discuss its findings. At 6 p.m., the football players gathered once again in the team room in the north end zone. Many of the leaders from the 2020 team were off campus. Ellinger, Osai, and Stearns were preparing for the NFL draft. Sarkisian addressed the remaining players with more nuance than he had used at his press conference. He reinforced the message that Hartzell delivered about the importance of working from a common set of facts. Spring break was a week away. Sarkisian assigned everyone homework, read the report, and then they could have deeper conversations about it. The players filed out of the stadium, where the newly erected 12.5-foot-tall bronze statue of Julius Whittier stood. For much of the last half century, Whittier, who died 3 years ago, was the answer to a trivia question: who was the first black UT football letterman? Many Longhorn fans had never heard his name. That changed last summer. Whittier first put on a UT helmet 50 years before the 2020 athletes wrote their letter. Even then, it seems he had an inkling that his impact on the university would grow with time. One night in 1970, the story goes, Whittier and Billy Dale, the white running back who volunteered to room with him, were talking. "Billy, I'm never going to die," Whittier told Dale, "and you are." Dale didn't understand. He was the upperclassman, the starter, the team leader. Whittier rode the bench at the time. What was he talking about? Whittier replied, "I'm just trying to make you think."
The author of this, Ivan Mizell, has covered national college football since 1987, including for the Dallas Morning News, Sports Illustrated, and ESPN. Joe Levin, the other author, is a former Texas Monthly intern and is a senior at UT. Yeah, now we turn to state. This is the section about things happening here in the big city and the big state. This section is Food and Drink. It's History by Patricia Sharp. And the title of this month's column is In the Limelight. And it begins, Mario Martinez reflects on the humble machine that made cocktail history. In the cantina, the cocktail servers were adjusting their sequin miniskirts while waitresses in black lace-up vests, gaucho pants, and tall boots chatted and laughed in the simulated moonlight of the dining room. A gregarious young man named Mariano Martinez rushed around in white leather bell-bottoms, setting out bottles of tequila and fresh limes. The date was May 7, 1971, and it was opening night of the much-anticipated Mariano's Mexican Cuisine in the Tony Old Town Shopping Center of Dallas. At 5 o'clock, the door swung open and the crowd surged in and immediately started ordering frozen margaritas. In less than 2 hours, everything had gone straight to hell. It wasn't that everyone was drunk, but it did have to do with the margaritas. The first round was great, but pretty soon the bartenders were so backlogged they just started throwing ingredients in the blenders. No two drinks were alike, and everybody was complaining. One worker snapped at Martinez, "I got cramps in my hands from squeezing those damn limes. I'm going back to steak and ale, where all they want is bourbon and coke." The 26-year-old proprietor was terrified, imagining his reputation going down the drain along with gallons of lousy margaritas. Martinez, now 76, takes up the story he has recounted with gusto for 5 decades. "I tossed and turned all that night," he says. "The next morning I went to 7-Eleven for coffee and a pack of gum. While there, he glanced at the store's Slurpee machine, and it came to me in a flash, like a gift from God. If that thing could make a slushy soft drink, surely it could make a frozen margarita." When the Southland Corporation, a parent company of 7-Eleven at the time, declined to sell him one, he and a mechanically minded friend named Frank Adams bought a used SantaServe soft serve ice cream machine and lugged it to the restaurant. "We tinkered around with it," he remembers. "They installed a stronger motor and compressor to swirl and chill the ingredients, and then Martinez experimented with different amounts of tequila, orange liqueur, and fresh lime juice. A few days later, on May 11th, as they were setting the industrial-looking apparatus on the bar, he recalled a bit of advice from his friend Norman Brinker, the brains behind Chili's. Restaurant guru had cautioned that people wouldn't pay much for a drink made by a machine. He'd also warned him not to destroy the mood. So Martinez covered the shiny stainless steel box with wood grain contact paper. The icy green slush that would soon emerge from it was about to make cocktail history. A little sidebar here, slush fun. A 7-ounce frozen margarita was $1.25 at Mariano's in 1971. Nowadays, Martinez's bestseller by far is a $14 margarita made with Don Julio Reposado, Cointreau, and fresh lime juice. Its name is the Mariano, and it's on the rocks. Born in Dallas in 1944, Martinez grew up in a family with deep roots in the Mexican restaurant business. His mother, Vera, was related to the Cuellar family, which founded the Dallas-based El Chico chain in 1940. She worked as an administrative manager in the office of the Oak Lawn location, and his father, Mariano, put in 80 hours a week managing the upscale Lakewood area restaurant. In mid-century Texas, business and social success often depended on assimilation into the Anglo community. "The year before I started school," Martinez said, "we spoke only English at home, and my mother took my sister and me to Sanger's, sometimes even Neiman's, to buy clothes." They had a good life, a happy life, in spite of overt racism in Dallas, especially at school. In the 6th grade, Martinez recalls, "This white kid knocked me down. We started fighting, and he called me an effing Mexican." In high school, he says, "I would have one date with an Anglo girl, but then she'd say, 'My father said I can't go out with you again because you're Mexican.'" He hated school, with the exception of a single lesson on inventors. "I remember vividly the day we learned about Thomas Edison and the Wright brothers. Afterward, I thought, 'Ah, man, that's what I want to be.'" A famous Einstein quote became his mantra, "Imagination is more important than knowledge." When he dropped out in 10th grade, the principal said to his mother, who had reluctantly given her permission, "You're making a big mistake. He's going to end up in jail. You will rue this day." Vera left the office in tears, but Martinez remembers thinking, "I'll show him." For a few years, he lived in the fast lane, playing and singing in a band, thus the white leather bell-bottoms, and hoping for a music career. He had fun and made plenty of money, but he hedged his bets by getting a GED and a liberal arts degree from El Centro, now Dallas College. When reality finally caught up with him, he took out a small business administration loan, asked his grandmother for recipes, and turned to something he knew really well, the Mexican food business. As it happened, 1971 was an excellent time to open a restaurant. More and more women were taking jobs outside the home, and families were dining out more often. Mexican immigrants who provided the workforce for many of these new restaurants were bringing recipes for then exotic stuff like ceviche and mole poblano, adding to the state's beloved Tex-Mex repertoire of crispy tacos and cheese enchiladas. The fajita craze took hold and spread across the state thanks in large part to Mama Ninfa Lorenzo's Tacos al Carbon. Most importantly, in April of 1971, Texas legalized selling liquor by the drink in restaurants. No longer did diners have to tote bottles of booze to the table just to enjoy a cocktail. Martinez was in the right place at the right time. A savvy media observer, he never passed up a chance to talk about his machine. At one point, he had 11 of them at a single restaurant. When customers said, "You should have patented that thing, you'd be a billionaire," he would smile and nod. Privately, he had his doubts. It would have been about as ridiculous as putting two carburetors in a 57 Chevy, painting on some flames, and trying to patent it. Still, he was aware that he had kickstarted a movement that was changing the restaurant industry. Not only had he helped take tequila from hooch to haut, he'd also invented something that would have a profound effect on the way people consume cocktails, from pina coladas to frozen daiquiris and everything in between. 20 years and an ocean of frozen margaritas later, Martinez retired the sturdy original contraption to a place of honor in one of his restaurants. He was quite fond of the thing, but he didn't think about it often. He was focused on building a Dallas-area group of new restaurants. Then, in 2003, he received an unusual solicitation. The Smithsonian Institution wanted to know if he'd considered donating that first machine to the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. "I wasn't surprised," he says. He agreed, of course, and a curator, Dallas-born Raina Green, got busy. She researched the patent history of frozen drink makers, checked rival claims, and verified decades-old newspaper accounts. Her conclusion? His truly was the world's first frozen margarita machine. "The honor was beyond my dreams," Martinez says. When the day came to ship the machine, though, he was conspicuously absent. "I didn't go into work that day because I didn't want to see it leave the building," he said quietly. Martinez's five restaurants keep him busy these days, though he lets his staff, some of whom have been with him for 30 years, handle day-to-day operations. As for his modest little box, still covered in wood grain contact paper, it sits on permanent display not far from Julia Child's kitchen. On the museum's website is a statement declaring that it stands at the crossroads of a revolution, heralding the rise of regional Mexican food across America. To Martinez, though, it also represents a personal triumph. "It wasn't just a machine to me," he says. "In some ways, I'm still that little Mexican kid that got beat up in the sixth grade. It validated me, and that means a lot." And this little sidebar here in this column, machine learning, can your blender hack it? When it comes to margaritas, on the rocks is good, up is better. That said, there's a time and place, summer, Texas, when a frozen cocktail becomes urgently necessary. The trick is pulverizing the ice, a challenge for all but the brawniest of blenders. With that in mind, a couple of us gave up a Tuesday evening and a bit of sobriety to pit a $100 blender against a $200 Margaritaville Bahamas frozen concoction maker, the most basic in an ambitious line of party-starting appliances. The results? The blender produced a slightly crunchy marg, while the Margaritaville, which first shaves the ice, then gets to mixing, delivered a silky smooth product. Honestly, we couldn't tell much difference after the multiple batches required to settle on the recipe that we have here, but, of course, that was our own damn fault. That's by Courtney Bond. And the recipe for frozen margaritas is 4 ounces of silver tequila, 3 ounces of fresh-squeezed lime juice, 2 ounces of triple sec, like Contro, 1 ounce of simple syrup, and 2 cups of cocktail ice. Throw everything in the blender or the reservoir of your marg machine. Blend, pour into 2 chilled, salted glasses, and enjoy responsibly. And since we're already talking about it, the next section is food and drink. It's tacos by Jose Arrelat. Breakfast cousins, many times removed. Chilaquiles and migas are sometimes used interchangeably, but the two breakfast dishes have some fundamental and delectable differences. Arrive too late at Theodora's Bakery on any morning, and you'll find yourself staying in line on the sidewalk. 7 days a week, the crowd in Dallas's Oak Cliff neighborhood patiently waits for the restaurant's rapturous tamales, breakfast tacos served on spongy house-made flour tortillas, and a vibrantly colored array of pan dulce pastries. Spanish and English are heard sporadically from those gathered outside. Mostly there's silence. such as the intense draw of Teodoro's, even though the coronavirus has prompted management to shut down indoor dining. Before pandemic restrictions were imposed, customers would spend their mornings chatting with family and friends in Teodoro's cozy booths, and many of them did so over a plate of Pandaria's signature chilaquiles, an unassuming assemblage of salsa-covered crispy corn tortilla triangles topped with a joyful gyroscopic pattern of crema and a heavy shower of queso fresco with refried beans served on the side. Eggs and other proteins, including shredded chicken, are optional. Juana Pineda, general manager and sister of the bakery's semi-retired owner, Aurora Teodora Reyes, says chilaquiles are the panaderia's third bestseller after pastries and tacos. Judging from anecdotal experience, however, I'd say the chilaquiles seem to be the real draw. Then there are the migas, which can be ordered as a platter or a heaping bowl. As with most of the migas in the state, Teodora's are a lumpy landscape of scrambled eggs studded with pico de gallo, fried or crisp tortilla strips, and cheese. Oddly, in Texas, migas and chilaquiles are frequently confused with each other, especially in South Texas, where Mexican menus use the names interchangeably. The mix-up lies in the two dishes' common denominator, crunchy tortillas. But there's a difference in that regard. Migas usually feature short strips of fried tortilla, while chilaquiles use what are essentially tortilla chips. There are other distinctions, too. The tortillas and migas are mixed with scrambled eggs, chilaquiles are drenched in salsa, and though both dishes have roots in Mexico, their histories differ. Chilaquiles' genesis is largely indigenous. Migas' lineage reaches back to Europe. Yet many restaurateurs and restaurant goers continue to mistake one for the other, an error that happens more frequently now that chilaquiles are gaining popularity, especially among Anglos. If chilaquiles are on the verge of eclipsing their cousin, it might make sense for Texans to learn to tell them apart. Chilaquiles were created after Spanish conquest of Mexico. The name, as the magazine Mexico Desconocido has reported, is derived from the Mesoamerican Nahuatl word chilaquili, which refers to something that is covered in chili, as documented in a vocabulary book written by the Spanish priest Alonso de Molina in 1571. However, the first instance of chilaquiles that mentions something resembling the dish we know today appears in the 1828 recipe book Arte Nuevo de Cocina y Repostería Acomodado al Uso Mexicano, which refers to it as a dish of fried tortillas, clemole, a tomato and chili caldo common in central Mexico, pork or chorizo, and a pinch of sesame seeds. 3 years later, a trio of chilaquiles recipes, blancos, rojos colorados, and tapatios, were included in the cookbook El Cocinero Mexicano. Perhaps the earliest citation in the U.S. appears in El Cocinero Español, an 1898 collection of Mexican California recipes, which included instructions for the chilaquiles a la mexicana, which features olives. Chilaquiles tapatios a la mexicana, which is Guadalajara-style chilaquiles, also with olives, and chilaquiles con camarones secos, or dried shrimp. First known print mention of the dish being served in Texas turns up in a 1925 issue of the San Antonio newspaper La Prensa, Texas, and involves a fond remembrance of a feast of chilaquiles and refried beans. In the intervening century, chilaquiles topping options evolved, with eggs becoming a popular default. Yet the foundation of the dish has always remained those salsa-drenched chips. Today, the simple and satisfying chilaquiles platter is a fixture of Mexican restaurants. Recently, chilaquiles were inspired an eponymous business. In the summer of 2019, the husband and wife team of Orlando and Susana Aguirre opened a food truck called Chilaquil in San Antonio. Last October, Chilaquil moved into the food hall of the historic Pearl District. There, the dish is available as a platter. It's chips smeared with salsa roja or enough salsa verde to tinge them green. Chips are then topped with crema and cheese, a shot of chopped cilantro, a fan of avocado slices, and a knot of brilliantly pink pickled onions and buttressed by refried black beans. Though most customers order them topped with fried eggs, it's not required. In Texas, most people say chilaquiles need to have an egg on top, but they don't, explains Orlando Aguirre. That's a choice and one of the differences between chilaquiles and migas. The origins of migas lie in early 20th century Mexico. The dish is created out of necessity during the Mexican Revolution and its disastrous consequences, including a brutal famine. Cooking migas, Spanish for crumbs, was a way to repurpose stale bread and therefore extend scarce food resources. A descendant of the day-old bread dishes served across Spain, it evolved into variations of a soup thickened with loaves or rolls, something very different from the migas Texans can find today at most Mexican restaurants. These brothy Mexican-style migas gained popularity at Migas La Guerra, a restaurant in Mexico City's Tepito neighborhood that was opened in the mid-60s by José Luis Frausto and his wife, Celia Patiño. In a 2018 El Universal article, Luis Frausto said he first tried a restorative bowl of migas after a soccer match when he was a child. The recipe used at La Guerra which to this day is kept secret by the couple's children, is reportedly based on his memories of that dish, though some sources give Patiño credit for the recipe. The success of La Guerra's Migas, a steaming, ready-hued and herbaceous pork broth thickened with old bread and served with or without pork bones, inspired countless imitators, and today similar migas are served at stands and restaurants across Mexico City and its surrounding municipalities. A Texas reference to this dish appears as a recipe in a 1922 issue of La Prensa, Texas, but this is not, of course, the eggy, broth-free preparations that most Texans are familiar with. First known mention of something resembling that dish showed up as another recipe in a 1951 edition of the Brownsville Herald. The instructions call for powdered eggs, onions, tomatoes, chili powder, and fried strips of tortillas. It's tempting to regard this seemingly Americanized dish as yet another Texan adaptation of Mexican cuisine, like chili con carne and puffy tacos, but the story isn't so clear-cut. When sisters Reina and Maritza Vasquez were growing up in Veracruz, Mexico in the 80s and 90s, they often ate a version of migas that was a lot like Tex-Mex migas. "We grew up eating migas from leftovers," Reina said. "We always had leftover tortillas. The next day, we'd scramble eggs and throw in the tortillas and whatever we had left, some veggies or chorizo or bacon." After the sisters immigrated to Austin in 1999, became interested in opening their own food business, wanting to offer dishes evocative of their youth, they went in search of the Tex-Mex-style migas they'd grown up with, but the migas they tasted during their research at local restaurants and food trucks had thinner, soggier chips than the ones they remembered. Sisters tinkered in the kitchen until they settled on a recipe built with their own homemade tortillas. That's the original migas taco, later joined by migas poblanas, available at Veracruz All Natural, the sisters' popular fleet of Austin-area trailers, trucks, and brick-and-mortars. That dish is a mix of scrambled eggs, tortilla chips, Monterey Jack, chopped onions, cilantro, and tomatoes, and is finished with an avocado wedge and usually served in a fresh corn tortilla. It's often named one of the best tacos in the city and state. It's a breakfast taco that draws lines of customers. Maybe it's the feel of the crunchy tortilla strips juxtaposed with the soft house-made corn tortilla that brings so many people to the restaurant's door. But the intense demand might be the dish's undoing, as the migas taco is, in my experience, somewhat inconsistent. It's unusual for the otherwise dependable Veracruz All Natural. Sometimes the filling is salty, sometimes it's bland. On occasion, the dish is served cold. Still, Veracruz's migas tacos have gained national renown via South by Southwest attendees who have raved about them on social media. Migas aren't the only dish made from leftovers that the Vasquez sisters fondly remember from their childhood. "My mother would make a pot of chilaquiles for the whole family," Reina says. And so in 2011, 2 years after the sisters started serving tacos, they added chilaquiles to the menu as part of a series of brunch specials. Today it's served as a breakfast taco at the downtown location and will soon be added at other locations. Anyone who still confuses migas and chilaquiles can clear that up uncertainty by going to Veracruz All Natural and ordering both of them. There's really no mistaking one for the other. While eggs dominate the migas, when it comes to the chilaquiles, it's all about the salsa. As Reina puts it, the sauce is the bomb. And that brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturdays at 5 p.m. and Mondays at 2 p.m. on site and to sound broadcasting.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The West Texas Blowout has been scheduled for May 22nd at the Midland County Horseshoe Amphitheater. Doors open at 3:30 p.m. Featured entertainment will be presented by Eric y su Grupo Masore, Ruben Ramos and the Mexican Revolution, Tristan Ramos, La Mafia, Los Musicales, David Lee Garza, Jay Perez, Ram Herrera, and Savannah. For tickets or more information, visit westtexasblowout.com.
Now airing on the Noon Book Hour, Recording Library of West Texas Radio proudly presents the novel which was the basis for the classic film starring James Dean, Elizabeth Taylor, and Rock Hudson, Giant, a novel. Giant is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Edna Ferber's sweeping generational tale of power, love, cattle barons, and oil tycoons, set in Texas during the first half of the 20th century. When larger-than-life cattle rancher Jordan Bick Benedict arrives at the family home of sharp-witted but genteel Virginia socialite Leslie Linton to purchase a racehorse, the two are instantly drawn to each other. But for Leslie, falling in love with a Texan was a lot simpler than falling in love with Texas. Upon their arrival at Bick's ranch, Leslie is confronted not only with the oppressive heat and vastness of Texas, but also by the disturbing inequity between runaway riches and the poverty and racism suffered by the Mexican workers on the ranch. Leslie and Bick's loving union endures against all odds, but a reckoning is coming, and a price will have to be paid. Giant, a novel by Edna Ferber. Weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Please come back for your routine visits. Dr. Roach writes, recent data have shown that the number of breast cancer diagnoses in the past year is dramatically down. This is not good news, since it means there are more cases of undiagnosed breast cancer. Anecdotal reports from my breast cancer colleagues confirm that women are showing up with more advanced breast cancer than in the past. I am sure that part of this is due to people who need mammograms not being able to or feeling uncomfortable about going to get them during the pandemic. I am sure also that this phenomenon isn't limited to breast cancer. All kinds of screening and preventive care needs to be done in a timely fashion for both women and men. Please come back for your routine visits.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 89 and cloudy. Tonight, a few showers with a low in the low 70s. Then tomorrow, a few showers with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the May issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the article titled The Bind, Finding Common Ground on a Road Trip from the Panhandle to the Rio Grande Valley by Clayton Maxwell. One and indivisible, these two words conclude the compact 17-word pledge of allegiance to the Texas state flag. For the past year, I've heard my 11-year-old son recite the pledge every morning during online school. Because most of my interactions with the rest of Texas during this pandemic have been through a laptop, those two words burrowed in and left me asking, if we are indivisible, what unites us? What common ground do I share with Texans up in the dry flatlands of the Panhandle, or with those in the balmy valley of the Rio Grande? Sometimes finding an answer means you've got to turn off the laptop and drive. On the morning of January 2nd, my husband, son, and I borrowed a camper van from a neighbor, loaded up our dog, Jake, and headed out on a six-day expedition. With our face masks hanging on easy access hooks, we set out to traverse the state from the Oklahoma border to the Gulf, exploring new places and meeting new people. On the way, we hope to find what values we share with a few of the other 29 million people who call Texas home. It was a tall order. Our state is too big and complex to condense into a simple pledge. And yet, as the van's odometer clicked on, we met a diverse set of Texans who, despite living very different lives, all had one thing in common, a fierce dedication to their callings and communities. After an 8-hour drive from our Austin home, we pulled into Canadian, a panhandle town of 3,000 along the Canadian River, and checked into a revamped motel called the Last Cowboy's Court. Our room was a warm hug for road-weary souls, with a crimson clawfoot tub, coffee from the local brown bag roasters, artisan soaps, and ranching photos on the walls. My husband, Scott, in describing the boutique lodging's refined touches, used a Spanish word, esmero, which translates to care. but esmero means more than care. It emanates from the heart. As a Spanish professor described it to me, someone doing something with esmero shows a deep love for that what she does, as if doing it gave sense to everything in life of this person. And, we were soon to find out, there's plenty of esmero here, not just at the last cowboy's court, but throughout Canadian. The next morning, we met Tiffany Kirkland, then a waitress at the Canadian restaurant. Wearing a trucker's hat with the words Red Dirt stitched on the front, Kirkland not only knew the names of almost every customer who walked in, she also knew their orders from the menu of classics like omelets and steaks. With country music playing in the background, Kirkland refilled our coffee and told us how the town made it through 2020. "We helped each other," Kirkland said. "When a family had to quarantine, we brought them casseroles, or we'd pick up kids from school. Canadian's a close-knit community. We've known each other most of our lives, and our parents have, too." As the oil industry here dried up, a consequence of geopolitics, oversupply, and reduced demand during the pandemic, Kirkland's oil field customers disappeared as well. But the rancher still came in every morning. "This is Jimmy Schaefer," she said, pointing to a photo on the wall of a man in a white cowboy hat staring into the eyes of a longhorn. "He just randomly shows up and hangs his pictures on the wall. He's 91 and comes in every day. If he misses a day, we call." A day ago, Canadian was a dot on my computer screen. Now it was real faces and the biggest pancakes my son Harry had ever seen. Our next stop was the office of the Canadian Record, where we met Lori Ezel Brown, the record's editor and publisher since she and her mother took over from her late father in 1993. Brown explained how the oil slump and closures from the coronavirus pandemic have put Canadian in a precarious place. "Every week we hear about a business closing, a business laying off their employees, a business relocating," Brown said. "But Canadian and surrounding Hemphill County have a long history of challenges. In 2017, a megafire swept across this part of the panhandle, killing cattle and turning the land black. People came from across Texas and beyond, hauling hay and water for surviving livestock, along with fencing materials to help ranchers rebuild. It was staggering, the damage, but we rebounded tremendously," Brown said. "When you're fighting the pandemic, when you're fighting wildfires, when you're fighting all the things that are affecting us right now, the question is, how are we going to get through this together? 9/10 of the people who come through the door of the newspaper say, 'I don't always agree with you, but you sure put out a great newspaper.'" "It's possible for us to have different viewpoints and still get along. Actually, in a town like this, it's essential." We hit the road again to meet John Erickson, whose series of Hank the Cowdog books are loved around the globe. On the drive to Erickson's ranch, about 45 minutes from Canadian, Harry read Hank's stories out loud, switching voices from Hank to Drover, his sidekick, to Pete, the barn cat. The dirt road to Erickson's house, Hank's road, leaves the flatlands behind as it dips into a scarlet canyon. Chris, John's wife of 53 years, greeted us in front of the new house they'd just finished building after their previous home burned in the 2017 fire. As we talked in the spacious new living room, with unobstructed views of the blue sky and red caprock, I saw how much Erickson loves this land. "It's a beautiful piece of God's creation, and it nourishes my spirit every day," said Erickson, who grew up in nearby Parrington. I put myself in the position to be the medium that pulls thoughts, emotions, symbols, mythology, whatever it is, out of the atmosphere, and put it into a form that brings delight to families. I really don't know how that happens. Erickson pursues his craft with a devotion that goes back to the biblical stories his mother told him as a young boy. "Art should make people laugh or cry or come to a deeper appreciation of who they are in this infinite universe that we occupy," he said. "It should aspire to the same standards that the lady in Parrington who makes hot tamales for my wife, adheres to, which is, you must make your customer better. It's a relationship of trust. Esmero, it seems, manifests in both writing and tamales. Too soon, we said our goodbyes and headed for Paladuro Canyon State Park, our destination for the night. We traced the Canadian River east before heading south through Amarillo and arriving at the park